This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks with Michelle Owen, Alex Crook and Sam Matterface.
Hello everyone and welcome to the latest edition of All Football Commentators Are Geeks. I'm Sam Matterface from ITV and TalkSport.
I'm Michelle Owen from Sky Sports News and Soccer Saturday.
I'm Alex Crook, TalkSport commentator and national newspaper journalist.
And I'm Ian Dark.
Coming up, I'll be taking you behind the scenes at Old Trafford, Anfield and Stamford Bridge and aiming to give you a unique insight into life on the road as a commentator at some of last week's biggest matches, including calling three of the best goals you will see all season in the same week.
It'll be my turn to have a good old moan in the red zone.
And we will be going head to head for the crown of Geek of the Week in Stat or Spin.
They don't know how to make small talk, but they do know when Raheem Sterling last scored for England. This is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
Okay, let's get to the action. Michelle Owen is here. Hello.
Hello, Sam. Hello, Crook.
And you two were together in Bournemouth on Monday night. And occupying the same space at the same time. Was it a nice first meeting? Did you enjoy each other's company? There wasn't any fallouts or competing over interviews or anything like that?
No, what was a bit weird is Crook came down and we sat and chatted. And he was like, I'm going to get a drink. And that was at like 10 to 7. And he came back at 20 past 7. And I was like, oh, I just don't think he likes me. I just think he's gone.
That was because one of us had to do work. And
One of us had a slightly busier time than the other last night, to be fair.
You were coasting, were you?
I wouldn't say I was coasting, but I was working for Premier League Productions last night, and it's very different than doing a Sky shift. During the game, you do nothing. You do stuff pre-match and post-match. So I got to sit and watch and enjoy a very enjoyable first half. And a brilliant David Brooks goal.
Okay, it has been a manic week for all of us going up and down the country in the Premier League, the Champions League, Carabao Cup, EFL. Crookie, do you want to start by telling us what impressed and depressed you this week?
Well, Michelle's already alluded to it. I couldn't not be impressed by that goal from David Brooks last night. A wonderful finish, left-footed, off the underside of the crossbar. And we saw some fabulous strikes in the Premier League this weekend, but that was right up there. And what's interesting about David Brooks, I was speaking to a member of the Bournemouth backroom staff after the game. They weren't expecting him to make much kind of an impact at all this season. He was signed as one for the future. They were going to bed him in slowly, much like they did with Lewis Cook in his early days. But he was so impressive during their summer warm-up matches that Eddie Howe just couldn't leave him out. And it just shows that you can find some bargains if you look in the right places in the lower leagues. I was impressed with the Bournemouth programme last night as well, for personal reasons. The front page feature was a picture of Junior Stanislas. He was their big interview, sat on the same bench where my wife and I a few weeks ago had our wedding pictures. And the reason they did that is because the cameraman, who was one of the Sky cameramen who filmed our wedding, showed off his work to the Bournemouth press officer. And he thought, that looks an amazing spot just down the road from the stadium. We've never used it. Let's go there and do a photo shoot. So
so you inspired the Bournemouth programme, the front cover of the Bournemouth programme.
Absolutely. But I would say that I think my wife looks better sat on the bench in her wedding dress than Junior Stanislas. No offence, Junior.
I think she probably looks better in her wedding dress than you would do sitting on the same bench as well, which is probably quite fortuitous they didn't use that image. What depressed you?
Jose Mourinho. He depresses me every week. He depressed me by picking Scott McTominay as a centre-half. That's probably for another podcast. He depressed me with his antics at the training ground last week when, just to put this into some kind of context very quickly, Sky only get access to Manchester United training once a month to go and film training shots. That's in the contract. It's the same at most clubs. Jose Mourinho will have known the Sky cameras were there that particular day, and he made a show of giving Paul Pogba a public rollicking to embarrass him in front of the nation. Poor man management again. And then just to top it off, they go and get hammered at West Ham, and I'm told Jose Mourinho tried to duck out of doing the post-match radio interviews. He did the same thing to me when they lost at Brighton. He walked out, and I said to the press officer, radio? Oh, we forgot. How can you forget? You have to do the same commitments for television and radio every week. It's cowardly. Your team have been hammered. It's your fault because you've picked the wrong tactics. You're not inspiring the players. Come and explain yourselves to the fans and to the people who pay a lot of money to get this post-match access.
Do you have that problem as well sometimes, Michelle, where you're sort of waiting in the tunnel for a manager and then they refuse to speak to you?
No, very rarely, because with Sky, because they're rights holders, they have to come out. If not, they get fined. Particularly at Premier League games, there's a time limit on it. I think it might be 30 minutes for TV.
Yeah, it is.
Correct me if I'm wrong. I think that's right. I did one with Warnock a couple of weeks ago. And he turned to his press officer, he went, oh, how long was that? And he went, 30 minutes. He said, oh, that's all right then. And they know, like, they full on know. And a lot of them will use 29 minutes and 59 seconds to keep you waiting. So, yeah, the longest I've been kept waiting, probably in League One or League Two, I was left waiting for Chris Wilder the other week in the Championship for about 45 minutes, I think.
So
they keep you waiting,
happens,
but they have to do it. Also, what some clubs do is they don't send out the manager, they send out like an assistant. You're like, oh, well, like, with all due respect, he's not who we want to hear from.
Yeah, and that is a real tricky one, because then you've got to ring your editor and say, hold on a second, I've only got the Gianfranco Zola, when really you wanted to hear from Maurizio Sarri. And, you know, that's a bad example,
exactly,
because Zola's a big name. But, you know, in the context of if you're doing Sheffield United and Chris Wilder sends out his assistant manager, no disrespect, but they're not going to use that. Sky are not going to run
that. And it happened at Leeds last week when, instead of Marcelo Bielsa, we had one of his assistants. So it's like, okay.
Michelle, what's impressed and depressed you?
Well, I'm going to have to share the impressed this week, because Crook sort of nicked mine, but he's fully allowed to. That programme cover, when he sat down and told me, I almost didn't believe him.
This is a Crookie loving.
I put the picture on our Instagram story. And I was like, this is a lovely picture. This is very unusual for a programme. And then when he told me the story, and then he showed me the picture of his wife, which we'll put on the Instagram, we'll put them side by side. I was quite impressed that the power that Crook has on the South Coast. Who knew? Just a couple of weeks ago, we were questioning his validity to even be sat here. But there we go. And depressed, also at Bournemouth last night. So we were meant to do our live just after 6, the first hit. And then the groundsman came down and was like, we need you to move because the sprinklers are coming on. I was like, look, 12 minutes. Can you give us 12 minutes? Because the latest I'll be done by is 6:15. And he's like, no, as soon as the referees go in, that's it. You have to be off the pitch because we'll be sprinkling. I was like, oh, but think about my hair. And sort of smiled at him and pulled that one out of the bag. And he's like, oh, I'll see what I can do. And then the referees came out and Mike Dean came over. And I was with Danny Higginbottom. I was like, Danny, just keep him chatting until we go live. So we wanted to delay the referees going off the pitch so the sprinklers didn't come on. Which we achieved to a point. Yes, we achieved it to 6:15. And then my producer goes, oh, we'll be another 5 minutes. So there's an almighty scramble to get over the hoardings. So we think we've got to safety. No word of a lie, started my live, the sprinkler came on behind me and my back got soaked. But there we are, that's the joys of doing lives by a football pitch, and they couldn't wait to put the sprinklers on. Thanks.
Talking about post-match interviews and pre-match interviews, I had to do one on Saturday night, and this is my sort of depress really, with a translator right by my side. Because I was doing, it was, not depressed maybe, sort of challenged me. I was talking to Maurizio Sarri. And we're in the tunnel, and it's really tight in the tunnel at Chelsea. It's really close, and everyone's sort of squished together, and you know what it's like. It's like there's 100 people after a Premier League match trying to get into a space which really only fits about 50. And everyone's a bit sweaty and a bit smelly, and they're trying to grab their interviews. Well, Maurizio Sarri, who's standing in front of me, has also got a rather large translator who is whispering into his ear as I'm talking. So as I'm asking him questions, so I might say, what did you think of the game? He's translating simultaneously into Italian in his ear. Now, you know what it's like. When you're talking and somebody else is talking exactly the same time, it's really off-putting. So I'm asking these questions and he's translating to Italian, and I can sort of hear him translating it into Italian, and then Sarri's looking at him but answering me in English, and it was just blowing my mind. And you know, like when you lose your train of thought or you start to slow down because you can sort of almost hear yourself coming backwards, it was really majorly off-putting. Anyway, if you want to contribute on that debate and you want to get involved in it, you can do. You can tweet us at AFC Geeks. You can get in touch via Instagram as well. The handle is the same, at AFC Geeks. You can send us your questions as well, and we'll answer as many as we can in the next episode. We're going to do that a little bit later in the programme after we've spoken to Ian Dark.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks or get in touch on Instagram.
Okay, it's time to find out who is the geekiest of us all as we play Stat or Spin.
Each of us will give out a fun fact and the other two have to work out if it really is a stat or if it's just made up spin. Michelle, what have you got for us?
Lift off and the clock has started.
Okay, so I'd expect you both to be able to get this one. It's about Portsmouth. Now, if they avoid defeat on Tuesday evening against Coventry, it will be their best unbeaten start since 1984 to 1985.
Oh, 1984-1985, they didn't get promoted that year, though, did they? They got promoted the year after to go up into the Premier League. So, not Premier League, it was Division 1 at the time. I'm going to say that's spin.
I better go stat, just to be contrary.
You do that every time, I swear. Okay, so that is a stat.
Ooh,
get in.
Is it true?
You wouldn't expect, would you? Yeah, you wouldn't expect, given what you just said, Sam, but that is a stat, that's true, so well done, Crooks.
Okay, my turn. Junior Stanislas scored the winner for Bournemouth in the game that Michelle and I were at on Monday night. It was his first Premier League goal of the season. He's had a terrible knee injury, which has kept him out for the past 6 months, so it was great to see him back. He's a genuinely lovely lad and, you know, a really good player as well. But did you know that his real name is not Junior? It's actually Felix.
That's a very random thing to make up.
Yeah, and also Junior isn't anyone's name, isn't it? Is it just, don't you just get called Junior because
it's Junior's
the same?
No, Junior's a name. I think Junior's a name, but it might be that...
They just get called that because your dad's name's Felix or whatever, and you're Felix too.
I don't know, because my granddad doesn't use his first name, he uses his middle name, which makes me think maybe it's like his middle name or a nickname or something like that. So maybe Felix is his real name. I'm going to say... Can I say that's a stat?
I'm going to go spin.
It is a stat. His name is Felix Junior Stanislas, but his mum didn't like the name Felix, so he goes
so
by
why
the
did
name
she give
Junior.
It to him then?
Why did she? That's what I was going to say.
Okay, Marcus Alonso, here's one for you. He's won the FA Cup. He's won the Premier League with Chelsea, but his success is dwarfed by his forefathers. His dad played in the European Cup final defeat for Barcelona in 1986 against Steaua Bucharest. His granddad played in all five of Real Madrid's European Cup finals between 1956 and 1960. And they are all called Marcus Alonso. Is that stat or spin?
Oh, wow. Crook, you go first.
I think it's spin. I think the roll of honour you read out may well be correct, but I don't think they're all called Marcus.
Oh, I'll go stat, because or in some countries, you know, they do like to have the same name, so I'll just go stat.
They are all called Marcus Alonso.
Wow.
But it's spin, because the grandfather only played in four of the five Real Madrid European Cup successes. So his dad played in the European Cup final. His granddad played in the European Cup final, and they're all called Marcus Alonso. It's amazing.
It is amazing, but I feel like you've tripped me up there.
that's kind of the aim of the game, Michelle.
Yeah, no, I know.
I made that a crooky win this week. 2 points for me, none for Matterface. Maybe one for Michelle.
One for me. Yeah, I need to see this league table, how it's coming along.
If you like the podcast, make sure you rate and review it on iTunes and subscribe via your podcast supplier.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.
It's time to welcome this week's special guest geek. Crook and Sam spoke to BT and ESPN commentator Ian Dark earlier this week and took us back to the early Sky Sports days. Ian was a part of the original team that shocked English football when the fledgling satellite startup took live league football away from terrestrial television for the first time.
Well, when we first started out, I think everybody was waiting with knives ready to stick in our backs and say, well, this is terrible, the coverage is awful, why have we given the rights to this backwater company, whoever they are? It's amazing to think how it has all grown. But I think when people did see the coverage and the new cameras, the new angles, and you hope the expertise of the coverage, they said, well, this is a bit better. And I think it did push the boundaries back. They were exciting days to be a part of. You know, remember Richard Keys and Andy Gray and them, well, not Andy Gray, Richard Keys in his multicoloured jackets and the Sky Strikers out on the pitch. Fans of a certain age will remember all that and the Monday night games, which the players got to like in the end. It was like being part of a pioneering operation.
And when you say the players liked it in the end, was there some resistance to the idea of playing games on a Monday night?
Yeah, there was. There really was. I remember going to cover Manchester United early on at Southampton, and Sir Alex Ferguson, things were a bit different then. He'd invited me to the hotel to sit and have a cup of coffee, and he gave me the team, and he was politeness and charm. And then I spoke to a couple of the players. One of them was Neil Webb, and he said, "Why the hell are we playing on a Monday night?" There was another word in there as well. They didn't like it at all, and it took a bit of getting used to it. Another story I remember is ringing Howard Wilkinson, who was the Leeds manager back then, on a coach. They were on their way to Norwich to play a Monday night game, and as we commentators do, I was trying to get a sniff of what the team might be, so he really gave me an earful. And so, why the heck are you calling me? Why are we in the snow travelling through Norfolk now? We could be sitting at home watching the TV. And he gave me a real earful for about 2 minutes about it. So I remember saying, maybe unwisely, I said, "So you'll be sending the cheque back, will you, Howard?" And he said, "Touché. What do you want to know?"
For some, it's sort of like a labour of love. We love preparing. And you just mentioned there about trying to get the team. That's something that commentators try to do all the time. And that requires making contacts with managers, with players, whatever. I think sometimes managers think you're trying to get the team because you want to get it out there before everybody else. But actually, the truth of the matter is, the reason you want the team is so that you can start preparing nice and early, isn't it? And getting everything you need for the players that are going to be on the pitch.
Well, absolutely. Yeah, you've said it. I mean, you do the job as well, Sam. So, yes, any kind of guide you can get ahead of schedule is great. But I think it's getting more and more difficult to do that, quite honestly. There's still a core of managers you can call on the morning and they will trust you and will give you the team. But I think now the majority say, why am I going to bother to do that? They're worried it will get out on Twitter. And I think social media doesn't help us in that regard. So most of us are left finding out the team, same as everybody else, about 75 minutes to go, which isn't that satisfactory.
You mentioned there about the audience, and you've had the privilege, I suppose, of working with the BBC, Sky, ESPN in the UK and the States, BT, PLP.
Yeah, I'm a media whore, I think, so.
What's it like being so in demand?
Well, I've not always been in demand. There are setbacks along the way. I think everybody who's in the business for some time, you will have a setback. There's no doubt about that. But it's interesting working for lots of different people, as I have at various stages of my career. In different ways, I've enjoyed it all, particularly working for the Americans at ESPN in the United States, where they do have a different way of going about things. But there's a bit we could learn from them, too.
What do you mean, a different way of going about things?
Well, they love a production meeting first thing in the morning. So you'll be finding yourself at breakfast at 8:30 for a 7:45 kickoff that night, talking through how the show is going to go. And you know, as the commentator, really the only bit you're going to have to do is call the game. So most of the meeting is about other things. But they do prepare thoroughly. And I must admit, there have been times in games when I've thought, just as well we did talk about that this morning, because it's here it is, that situation's come up in the game. So it's just a different way of doing things. I think they do it with a bit more energy, but that's just a style thing.
One of the things that you and I have talked about before, actually, is the idea of all the production meetings, the energy that goes into creating the programme before the game starts, and actually how much the commentator is very much left to his own devices. So you can spend all this money on gathering the rights and preparing for a big programme. So a big television company will put a massive wrap around a super game. But actually, when the whistle blows and they've handed over to the commentator, that's it. It's down to that person and that co-commentator. And I'm actually interested to hear, actually, because I think the guys from NBC say the same thing, that there's a lot more sort of input into the commentary from the production staff in America than there is over here. That is a big change.
I don't find that. No, I'm basically left to get on with it in my own way. They might ask me about which players are likely to be playing or what the system will be. If they've got a profile on a certain player, they'll just double check with you that he's almost certainly going to be in the lineup, so they've not wasted their production effort. But you're right what you say. Nearly all the preparation goes into what the studio is going to look like, the presenter, the pundits especially, the pre-match, but the commentary is a 90-minute ad lib, and who knows what's going to happen. But isn't that the glory of the game?
Obviously, as well as being one of Sky's main football commentators, you also led their boxing coverage. If you had to choose and could only cover one of the two sports, which one would it be? And what's the biggest difference between covering a Premier League football match and a world heavyweight title fight?
Well, in boxing, which I don't cover anymore, by the way, I haven't done it for a few years now, but of course, identification, that's not a problem in boxing. There are only two people out there, so God help you if you can't do the identification part of it. The other big thing, of course, with boxing is you don't know what the score is, so you're trying to give the viewers or listeners a clue as to who you think is winning the fight, and you hope you're not leading them down the garden path. But with some of the strange judging that goes on, particularly in Las Vegas, of big fights, that is a big danger. Now, they're very, very different, and there's far more prep required, I think, for football matches. But you can largely do that on your own. With boxing, you sort of have to hang around the fight a bit during the week and be at the press conferences and the weigh-in and just get the feel and the mood of it.
Arguably, one of your most famous assignments was the Mike Tyson-Evander Holyfield fight where Tyson bit Holyfield's ear. How surreal was that at the time?
Well, I think that's a classic case of it being an ad lib. Who could say that was going to happen? You just hope that you spot it and are suitably outraged, and I think I was. That was an amazing night, really. It was the only time I've ever heard the famous American promoter Don King told by an interviewer, "Shut up, Don," as he was trying to interrupt an interview with Mike Tyson.
Oh, and some nasty stuff in there. There needs to be a bite almost. Holyfield is very unhappy. Look at this.
That's the kind of experience, though, that people love to hear about, being in those scrums and seeing those famous events. I mean, you were in boxing in those days, in the 80s, when it was absolutely massive in this country. You were the BBC's boxing correspondent for a while, weren't you?
Yeah, BBC Radio, yeah. Because I worked in the BBC Radio sports room, which is a bit of an academy, you know, it's produced so many people who've gone on to be, biggish or big names, John Inverdale and for the current generation, Jim Rosenthal, Alan Parry, Tony Adamson, Mike Ingham, you know, and so on. Many, Peter Jones, Brian Butler, the great sort of gods of yesteryear. So it was a privilege and a pleasure to work there. And you learn so many disciplines being part of all that.
You mentioned earlier about the ESPN experience. How did that come about and your involvement in American football, soccer? And didn't you become a national hero by doing so?
Here's a very funny thing, you know, Sam. I've never actually been nominated for any award, and probably quite rightly so. But Sports Illustrated, the famous American magazine, named me the best newcomer to American sports broadcasting, and I was 57 at the time. So how that came about was I did the World Cup in 2010 in South Africa for them, and I was doing the USA's game against Algeria, and they were seconds from going out of the World Cup. You remember they were in England's group that time. They couldn't get a winner against Algeria. They were going out. In about the 94th minute, Landon Donovan scored the goal, which not only sent them to the knockout stages, but meant they topped the group ahead of England. So in 1 second, the whole scenario was changed. I don't remember what I said at the time, but I've heard it back many times since, and it apparently became this fairly iconic piece of commentary in America. I was bombarded with radio stations asking me to talk about it, and I couldn't believe really the reaction to it. So it was a once in a career type of thing, but it definitely did change my career.
Donovan has scored! Oh, can you believe this? Go, go, USA! Certainly through! Oh, it's incredible! You could not write a script like this!
When you hear it now, it sounds ridiculous, but it's just what instinctively came out of my mouth in that kind of, well, almost orgasmic moment for US soccer. I said, go, go, USA. A weird thing to say, and I'd probably never say it again, and it sounds strange now, but I think in context of the moment, and I think every commentary clip has to be gauged like that, it was right, I think.
Is it right that you've got your own chant among USA football fans? And if it is, can you give us a rendition?
No, if there is one, I've never heard it. Somebody told me that I've got a fake Ian Dark account there or something. And then I looked in the crowd at one of the World Cup matches 4 years later in Brazil, and there was some guy wearing a sort of fake mask, which looked vaguely like me as well. So I think you got to take any hero worship you get, and there's not much of it as a commentator, and all the detractors you get, and there's plenty of that as well, with a bit of a pinch of salt. I mean, you know what social media is like with Twitter these days. Don't look at it really if you're a commentator, especially at halftime during the game, because generally speaking, you'll be slaughtered.
Brilliant. Okay, so what we're going to do now is just go through some of our quickfire questions. We did this with John Champion last week, just to get a little bit more from you that we maybe didn't get in our long interview. Is that okay?
Yeah, go.
What is the one thing you take with you to every game?
A pair of binoculars to have a close look at the players in the warm-up to try and improve the identification.
Which summariser keeps you on your toes the most?
Well, going back, it was Andy Gray, and I say this in a nice way. If you said something he didn't agree with, he'd certainly let you know about it on air.
What's the name you've most struggled to get your tongue around?
I've actually looked back, and it's a bloke who used to play for Fulham, who I think you say Kachanaklis. See, I can't say it now. You remember him, Sam?
Yeah, I do.
Yeah, I struggle with that name all the time. I used to dread him getting the ball.
What's your favourite app or website to help you prepare?
I like TLS Football. I think that's very good with teams and in formations, and you can go back quite a way on it.
Worst journey you've ever done?
No question about it. At the 2014 World Cup to Recife in Brazil to cover the USA v Germany, we travelled through about 3 feet of water the whole way. I was amazed we ever got there.
Worst place you've ever stayed on your commentary travels?
That would be a guest house in Port Elizabeth, South Africa, at the World Cup in 2010, where one woman was checking everybody in, making the breakfast, doing all the books and everything else. And we were told that we should keep all our doors locked because there'd been a break-in the night before and somebody had been injured in an assault. This was a FIFA-approved hotel, by the way. They didn't send Sepp Blatter around to sort it out.
Favourite goal you've ever commentated on?
I think it would be that Landon Donovan goal because of what it meant in my career, the one where it rescued the USA from being knocked out at the World Cup and sent them top of the group.
And would that also go down as your most memorable game?
No, it wouldn't. I think the most memorable game, I did it with Steve McManaman in Brazil, was that semi-final, that amazing semi-final when Germany beat Brazil by 7-1. And we put the microphones down at the end. I said to Steve, people are still going to be talking about that game in 50 years' time.
Most accommodating club in the Premier League?
Well, you're liable to get in trouble, aren't you, doing this, because all the others take offence. But I think I'd give it to Arsenal, really. That spacious, lovely media lounge, and they look after you a bit and give you a nice bit of food before the game, and it's a good commentary position too.
If you could go back in time and call any sporting moment, what would it be?
Not an original, this, but I think you'd have to be, for any football commentator from our nation, England winning the World Cup in 1966. But of course, none of us would have done it better than Kenneth Wolstenholme.
And what one change would you make to your job to make it easier?
I think a lot of the commentators would say this one. I would say teams in stripes should be made to wear numbers that you can see, because an awful lot of them, it's a real job. So that is an order that should go out from the Premier League and the Football League to make sure that we can identify the players via the numbers. So, yeah, it's a technical one. It's a commentator's trade one. But I think I definitely back that.
See, he agrees with me. He's in my red zone rant. No commentator likes to have striped shirts with a number on the back. I saw it at Huddersfield the other day as well, and it's a nightmare.
No, but we all agree with this. I was at Wickham v Norwich last Tuesday night in the Carabao Cup, and Norwich were wearing lime green shirts with white numbers. It wasn't even stripes this time, but under a floodlight, you cannot see those numbers. And of course, someone scores early on and you're like, oh, brilliant. But I loved what he said about identification. I love that it's not just me that struggles a little bit sometimes. It makes me feel like I'm part of this collective where we all just hate the striped shirts and numbers and we're looking for the colour of the boots. And then the worst thing is, isn't it, when someone has the same colour boots.
Yeah, I remember Mike Ingham commentating the Champions League semi-final, I think it was, when Manchester United came back from 2-0 down to win in Turin. They beat Juventus 3-2. And the last goal, I think it was Dwight York was going through on goal. He got tripped by Buffon and Andy Cole actually came in and tapped the ball into the net. But Mike Ingham had looked away sort of for a split second and didn't realise it was Andy Cole putting the ball in the back of the net and gave it as a Dwight York goal. I know it's an error that haunts him to this day.
Yeah, I remember. He got a lot of stick for that, but ultimately, when you're in the, I don't know if you've ever been to the Stadio dell'Alpi, you're miles away from the pitch, and if you glance down at your notes for 1 second, or you're looking at the watch to see what time it is or whatever, and then you look back up, sometimes you do get a little bit confused quickly.
It's really easily done. I mean, it's not quite as glamorous as the locations you guys have just been talking about, but Bristol City, you're up in the gods. And I know people use binoculars there, but I find binoculars really disorientating, you know, like when you look in and then you come back out and they're all tiny men again. So I understand why people use binoculars, but I never have, ever.
You have to get the right pair.
My ones from Poundland aren't.
I was going to say, the ones I've got aren't worth taking. They're like 15 quid from an airport lounge or something ridiculous. Like
right.
That.
Well, after last week's assault on press room food, by the way, the Bournemouth food Monday was very good. And let's find out what leaves a bad taste in Crookie's mouth. Oh my God, that sounds wrong.
Probably quite a lot, to be honest with you.
Just thinking about the pizza at Bournemouth last night. But funny enough, that's
it was
not...
cold, wasn't it?
Yeah, not ideal. Cold pizza, not fantastic. But that's not my rant, actually. My rant is about the Americanization of English football, and particular when the teams come out before a game. You can't go to a Premier League match now without the pitch being lined with giant plimps chucking out flames as the players emerge from the tunnel to some random piece of pop music, which is way too loud and therefore kills off any kind of natural atmosphere. I was at Southampton Brighton the other week, the derby that's not really a derby, and they dim the lights in the stadium and put on this way over the top lightning show. I could remember you, Sam, at Kylie Minogue. It was naff. At half time at Wolves on Saturday, they even gave the referee and his assistants the same treatment. Plimps chucking out flames as they came out of the tunnel at half time.
That was such a killjoy. I went to Wolverhampton Wanderers on the opening day of the season, actually to the Burnley game not too long ago, and they've got these great big fire cannons and they're all around the pitch. So when the players come out, there's just like shots of fire into the air and there's flames everywhere. It makes it really warm, I must admit. You can almost feel your eyebrows being singed if you're in the front row of the top tier of the main stand. But it just adds to the atmosphere. Chelsea do it. They turn the lights off. It's something that happens in the NFL and in the NBA and whatever.
Yeah,
and
but this isn't the
that.
NFL. And it doesn't add to the atmosphere. It takes away from it.
Yeah, it adds to the atmosphere, gets people revved up. I mean, you need it at Southampton, don't you, to get them revved up? Because otherwise, they just sit there Instagramming each other all day.
Oh, I was just going to say, I would take the positives from this. And like Sam said, nice and warm. I was at Bristol City on Friday against Aston Villa, and they had the flames going there. And I was up in the gods. I was like, oh, I'm getting a little bit of heat here. This is quite nice. So I'll take the positives from it every day.
I think you're right. I think you're just being a curmudgeonly old git.
It's nonsense. English football is not about all that. It's about drinking cups of Bovril. I had loads of them at Bournemouth on Monday night. It's about a crackly PA system that you can't really hear and slightly obese blokes trying to hit the crossbar to win a tenner at halftime.
That's why you probably fit in, yeah.
Tweet the Geeks at AFC Geeks
or get in touch on Instagram.
One of the main reasons we conceived this podcast was because we knew how much the ordinary fan wanted to know about what goes on behind the scenes at a big match. What happens when the camera stops rolling at the end of a TV interview, or the stuff that maybe does not make the cut from a manager's post-match press conference, and also the extensive and very geeky preparation that goes into a 90-minute commentary, which often Sam will do and Alex as well. So we tasked Sam with recording his movements from the games he had covered between Liverpool and Chelsea twice and Manchester United's EFL Cup defeat to Derby. Let's have a listen.
It is Tuesday morning and I've got Manchester United Derby tonight. Tomorrow I'm off to watch Liverpool-Chelsea. I've got to do a hell of a lot of prep, but I think I need to get out of here.
In my favourite coffee shop, looking for some nuggets of information from some of the local papers. It's important to try and delve as deep as possible into local websites, local papers, to get things that other people may not have in terms of statistical analysis or little stories that make a good tale. There's a great one about Mourinho and Lampard in the Derby Telegraph that I've unearthed, about how Mourinho was a really good sounding board when Lampard lost his mother. I think we'll try and bring that out tonight.
So we've just got some breaking news as we reach the press room at Old Trafford, and Matt Holland and I have been asked to go out and do a video for TalkSport explaining the breaking news that Paul Pogba has been told he'll never captain Manchester United again.
Paul Pogba will not captain Manchester United again, is the message from Jose Mourinho.
If that's true, then it's Mourinho or Pogba.
Day two, back in the cafe reflecting on Derby's magnificent win last night and going through the stats and stories ahead of Liverpool against Chelsea, part one.
So I've just got up into the press box at Liverpool and I've got a new coat on today. What do you think of it, Stuart?
Well, it's a lovely camel hair smoke moleskin type affair. The one thing I like about it is your trainers match it as well.
It's all about style, mate.
And it just, I didn't know whether to look at them or stroke them.
Oh, just finished at Anfield and seen one of the most amazing goals I think I've ever commentated on. Eden Hazard has stunned Anfield. Everyone walking out here is still saying what a fabulous goal that was. Whether they're a red, a press man, a neutral or a blue, it was an unbelievable goal. I think that's the best goal I've ever commentated on.
I've been down to Portsmouth for an event this weekend and now heading for the final leg of my three-match tour. I'm going to Stamford Bridge for Chelsea against Liverpool. And just going through the quotes from the press conferences. Alisson's is the best. The secret of the wise man is to learn from the errors of others, said the Liverpool goalkeeper. Unfortunately, in the Leicester game, it was my error. Got to use that. Just in the queue for the Chelsea buffet, which is world famous for its splendour and variety. Smoked salmon, little sweet chilli peppers, bread and butter pudding, sautéed prawns, pulled beef, the lot. I've been talking to Laura Woods about how she's going to throw to me for the team news. Now, usually we would start with the home team and then talk about the away team. But because Virgil van Dijk is such a big story, she's going to throw to me with a question about that. She's asked me if she can throw to a question about that and if we could leave with that, because that's the big headline. And we sort of discussed it, decided how we're going to handle it, and we thought that should be front and centre of what we discuss in the team news.
Wow, half-time in that Chelsea-Liverpool game. Chelsea leading by a goal to nil. Eden Hazard with what was another brilliantly crafted goal. Amazing Daniel Sturridge effort right at the very end to level things up at Stamford Bridge. It was a brilliant finish, but what a game between two great teams. I mean, if you're a Manchester United fan watching that, watching those two sides, you'd be thinking, crikey, we've got some way to go. Just explain to me what you were expecting to get from Daniel Sturridge when you brought him on as a substitute.
A goal or two. It simply is class.
So that's it. The week is at an end. And after three cracking games and a good three-hour journey back, I can finally chill out, maybe watch the Ryder Cup and a bit of Cardiff-Burnley.
I did watch a bit of Cardiff-Burnley, actually, and I thought Cardiff were absolutely appalling in the first half.
Oh,
and
that's, God. That
Sam Vokes goal. I mean, it was so basic, it was unreal. But it was a brilliant week. And one of the things that I thought was amazing about that that whole experience of sort of documenting it, listening back to it now, and just remembering the goals that I've seen this week. Probably the three best goals I think I've ever seen in 20 years of being a commentator. Harry Wilson's free kick at Old Trafford, which was unbelievable. Eden Hazard's goal at Anfield on Wednesday night. And then Daniel Sturridge's goal on Saturday evening. Unbelievable.
It's crazy when you sort of look back. I don't think we often have time to look back when you're doing sort of, I'm doing four games in 5 days at the moment. And you don't really have time to take in what you've seen because you're reacting to it and then you're prepping for the next one. So it's quite nice to hear you sort of reflect on what you've been doing. And it's only sort of because you've realised you've recorded it and listened back to it. Oh, yeah, actually, that was amazing.
That was amazing. I really liked actually doing the commentary on Saturday afternoon and the game in midweek. I actually messed up on Marouane Fellaini's equaliser on Tuesday night in the Derby game. No one really noticed. It was only me who sort of realised that I'd said the wrong word in the wrong place. But it left me in a really bad mood. I went back and I listened to it when I got back in and decided that I was just getting irritated with myself. So I had to watch something on TV to take my mind off it and didn't go to bed till about 1:30 in the morning because it was just irritating me too much.
We all have those moments, 100%. I do as well. And sometimes you listen or watch back to it and it's actually not as bad as you thought. So take comfort in that.
Yeah, it's interesting because maybe the folks at home don't realise that we do come home and scrutinise our work. I mean, I know you do, Sam. Listen back to your commentary in its entirety. I do the same. Obviously, Michelle will watch herself back on Soccer Saturday and work out what she could have done better and, you know, what she was happy with. I mean, my wife thinks it's because I like the sound of my own voice, which is partly true. But actually, you know, you do want to go over and almost reassure yourself because I think I never feel like I've completely nailed it at the time. And it's only when I go back and listen, I think actually that was okay. I'm my own harshest critic. And I think that's the best way to be as a broadcaster.
Absolutely. I honestly can tell you now that I never am satisfied with what I've done during a game. Never. Okay, we've got loads of questions that came in last week and this week, and I think we should get to them because we didn't get to enough of them last week. Daryl says, what's the best game you've commentated on and the best goal you've commentated on live? Crook, go for it.
Yeah, I've been racking my brains to think of a particular goal. That there's not too many, but basically based on what Michelle was saying, because we do so many games that stand out. I did do Manchester United against West Ham for TalkSport International when Rooney lobbed Joe Hart from the halfway line, so that was pretty spectacular. But I mean, no doubt about the best game I've ever covered. It was Boxing Day at Stamford Bridge. I was slightly hungover from the night before. Wasn't particularly looking forward. It was a 12:30 kickoff. I was thinking, this is probably the last place I want to be right now. It ended Chelsea 4, Aston Villa 4. And it was one of those games, and I think Darkie alluded to it in his interview, where I'd done all my prep. And literally, halfway through the second half, I shut my notepad and thought, I don't need these stats. I'm going to let the game do the talking. It was incredible. I think it was so incredible, Andrei Shevchenko even scored a goal.
I remember that game. I did it for TalkSport with Stan Collymore. I said John Terry wins the game for Chelsea, and then Kieran Clark scored 30 seconds later, and Stan said, did he? Did he? Did he? And then put his fist right in my face and went, did he? Did he? And he was getting all excited and screaming about it, so much so that the stewards had to come across, stand in front of the commentary box and stop the Chelsea fans from getting to him. True story. Michelle, best goal you've ever seen or reported on?
I've been thinking about this and it sounds terrible, but I'm not sure. I know that's bad, but I can give you the best game if that's okay instead.
Go for it.
And it's completely unglamorous. It was a couple of years ago in League Two. It was Exeter City v Yeovil Town. I think it was an international break. And in the 88th minute, Yeovil Town were 3-0 up at St James Park. And obviously, I thought, oh, they won't come to me again. 3-0, this is all wrapped up. Even when it goes to 3-1, sometimes they won't come to you. But because it was an international weekend, they took the 3-1 goal, which happened in the 89th minute. And by the 91st minute, it was 3-3. And it was just this insane turnaround. Like Sam said, you know when it's 3-0, you usually say, 3-0 looks like Yeovil Town have got 3 points here. They'll move up to whatever place that was at the time. And I've never seen anything like it. You're 3-0 down in the 89th minute. You would never expect that. And off the back of it, we did like a really nice feature with some of the goal scorers. But it was just one of those where I watched it back and I was like, oh, did I do that justice? Like we were just talking about earlier. And like you want to get excited, but not too excited. But when it's three goals in the space of 3 minutes from 3-0 down, like I said, not glamorous, not like the World Cup, not like the Premier League or anything. It just sticks in my mind as one of those where you literally never know what's going to happen. And as a fan, I would never leave a game early, like ever.
Matt Ills, who's at Matt Journo on Twitter, says, what's the most important part of a commentary, Crook?
I think the most important part of the commentary, as well as player identification, as Darkie's already alluded to, is trying to keep a game interesting when nothing is happening. We can all make ourselves sound like the best commentator in the world when there's loads of goals, there's loads of drama. But when it's a drab 0-0 draw on a cold Tuesday night somewhere like Exeter St. James Park, that's when a commentator really earns his dough, because you've got to keep the listener enthralled even when you're not particularly enjoying it yourself.
Couple of questions here from Jerry Nunn and from Daryl says, just a side question to add if possible. Do you ever struggle with being impartial when you're commentating? I know I would struggle. Looking forward to the podcast this week. Last week was good. Thanks, Daryl. Jerry says, how did you stay? And I think this is for me. How did you stay so calm when Didier Drogba scored the winning penalty in Munich? And it sort of all sort of goes into the same thing about impartiality. And I was having a conversation with Peter Drury about this on Saturday, because I was at Chelsea versus Liverpool. He knows I'm a Chelsea fan. He was at Watford somewhere else the previous week, and he's a Watford fan. And I said, you know, and we discussed it. And he said to me, "Are you nervous about today?" I said, "I don't really think of it like that. You know, when I'm working, when I know I'm working, I'm not thinking about my team winning or whatever. I'll think about it later when I'm on the train on the way home, or when I'm having dinner, or I'm sitting talking about the game afterwards. But you know, when I'm in the zone and I'm thinking about the match and I'm prepared for the match, and I've spent hours preparing for the match, I'm playing scenarios that could happen. Now, the most important thing in the world to me is to be completely unbiased, completely down the middle, and completely objective. I don't know how you guys deal with that, but I find it really easy to divorce myself from Sam the fan and Sam the commentator.
Yeah, I do as well. Although my boss at TalkSport Live did go through a phase when United was struggling in the David Moyes era, where his favourite party trick, and he used to take so much satisfaction, was putting me on a United commentary in a game that he knew they were going to lose and then listen to me commentate them lose.
I think you just sort of know it's your livelihood, don't you? And unfortunately, as much as we love being a fan of our clubs, that when you're there to do a job, you know, you're also talking to fans of the other club, you're talking to all the neutral fans, and I don't find it that hard. I thought I would when I did Villa last season and the season before. I thought I'd find it really hard, but it was okay. I mean, you know, I do get a little bit of joy, obviously, seeing Villa score, but I don't find it too hard. And also, I think you view it a little bit differently as well when you do come back to being a fan, because perhaps you speak to the manager and you see what they're going through. Like, for example, Steve Bruce at Aston Villa. You meet him after, you speak to him, and perhaps you don't have knee-jerk reactions that some fans have as well.
You're more calm because you've experienced a bit more information than other people have got, or you sit there and just think, oh God, I can't be bothered with it anymore. And you do sort of, you know, it maybe sort of dampens your enthusiasm for supporting them. On Jerry's question, how did you stay so calm when Didier scored the winning penalty in the Champions League final in Munich in 2012? The story is really simple. I did the Aguero moment about 2 weeks before. You know, when he scores against QPR and it just all goes off. Like, literally, the world goes off. Crook's crying because Man United are not going to win the title. Stan is screaming at me live on air. It was a culmination of a brilliant afternoon of dramatic football. My commentary of that moment was drowned out and completely obliterated by Stan and then me trying to compete with each other to get the moment out. And it sounded awful. Now, Chelsea obviously winning the European Cup, the Champions League, is a massive moment that will go down in the archives. So I was determined not to make the same mistake again. So I had a word with myself. I was lucky that it was a penalty shootout and I knew that this was the moment that they could win it. So I was on air with Andy Gray and I had a chance to sort of get myself poised before it happened, because it was a penalty shootout. When he scores, I knew exactly what I was going to say. Once I'd commentated on the moment, I could just give a perfect description of what happened and then that's it. And a penalty shootout sort of affords you that. But yeah, the reason I was probably calm-ish, and I wasn't calm, but I was in control, was because I'd had an awful episode about 2 weeks beforehand and I was determined that it wouldn't happen again.
Remember, you can subscribe and tell everyone else about us. Tweet us or find us on Instagram @AFCGeeks, and we'll get to your questions again next week.
So that's all we have time for. Thanks again for your company. We hope you enjoyed listening to the podcast as much as we enjoyed making it. The three of us will be back with another very special guest next week.
With more pens than friends, this is All Football Commentators Are Geeks.